Rabbit Hole, your favorite Bitcoin podcast.
But I don't want to go among mad people.
Oh, you can't help that. Most everyone's mad here.
What's up, everybody? It's your boy Kaz. What do you guys think of the new podcast intro? I like it a lot. I feel like it better encapsulates what I want for the show. Thanks. Got to give a shout out to my boy Dell Jefferson helping me produce it. And I'm here, as always, talking about Swan Bitcoin. Swan Bitcoin is the best way right now to buy Bitcoin. They allow you to dollar cost average now on a daily basis. So you can buy daily, weekly, monthly, and get it auto withdrawn to cold storage. I'm always saying it. The perfect time to buy Bitcoin was yesterday. So go to swanbitcoin.com/Kaz. You'll get $10 worth of Bitcoin when you sign up. In this episode, I speak with the technologist and author, Jeff Booth, started multiple companies, and he's the author of the book, The Price of Tomorrow, Why Deflation is the Key to an Abundant Future. He's also a visionary and a big proponent on Bitcoin. Jeff and I speak about inflation and deflation, the recent chaos as a result of world and global economic policies, monetary and fiscal, and what the future for Bitcoin is. So I hope you enjoy this episode of Down the Rabbit Hole. Hey, Jeff, how's it going? Good morning.
Hey, great. Yourself, Cass?
Hey, doing well, doing well. Appreciate you coming on the show today. I'm excited to get deep into the economics, and I think you have a very interesting view on economics that most of the world, I would say, doesn't agree with you on.
that's starting to change, and it's starting to change a lot. But I think when I wrote the book, you're right that it was very out there.
Yeah, I feel like we could partially be in an echo chamber as well, living sort of interacting with the same audience. There's a lot of Bitcoiners that believe that deflation, which we'll get into, makes sense. I think anybody that's reasonable thinks it makes sense, but obviously bankers and politicians don't want that.
Yeah, and we'll get into that, but I'll explain kind of why they don't want that. It's not that it might not make sense for them too, but the system is designed differently.
Right. Okay, so let's just give the audience a little bit of a background. I know you just said you don't want to toot your own horn a bit, but you're an entrepreneur. You started multiple companies. You've written a book called The Price of Tomorrow, Why Deflation is the Key to an Abundant Future, which is you're a technologist, but you're looking at this from a very economic point of view, and you're into Bitcoin. So tell us a little bit about the companies that you've started and why you decided to write the book.
I've started a number of companies. A lot of people know me for a company called BuildDirect that grew to about $500 million of market cap over 20 years. Lots of ups and downs on the way through that. But started numerous other companies as well. One in Southeast Asia right now called Knock Knock that last year at this time was doing $300,000 a month. Now it's doing over $8 million a month. So I chair a whole bunch of other companies. So what I would say is I understand how to construct a company and take advantage of technology today and how to build technology today for what's happening. I sit at an intersection right at the front edge of technology and have a really good case understanding of where it's going and also how to construct company value out of where it's going.
So would you say that you're a technologist or that you start technology companies? Like, do you write code?
I don't write code. I can write code. There's lots of people better than me at writing code. But I understand kind of the structure, how to hire, how to attract the best talent, where the intersection of creating value out of, typically creating value out of technology isn't one technology. A lot of people think it is. Like, it's, okay, AI, it's this. It's the intersection of orthogonal technologies moving together that create two different things that an entrepreneur puts together and says, wow, now we can break through market power. So if I had a superpower, that's my superpower. I see patterns that a lot of people don't see. And in fact, that's probably what led me to write the book, because at that intersection, when you understand how fast technology is moving and what it means for society that it or for a monetary system that was designed differently, you realize that those two things are incongruent. They won't work. And so when you look at around the world, all of the signposts, all of what's happening around the world are second and third order effects of that fight, an existing monetary system fighting against technological deflation.
So what is your background in? So how did you discover this superpower? Did you study technology in school? Are you self-taught?
Self-taught. I put a tweet up the other day saying education's free. We just don't know it yet. Right. And so think about what I just said, right? It's already free. You could learn anything from anybody. You could go as deep as you want. Research papers, scientific papers, the PhDs writing them on any subject. It's just your time and how you value your time that isn't free. And so that's already happened in anything, in any subject. Yet people still go to school for 12 years and then another 4 years and another 4 years, all because they think they will get a better job at the end of that, when it's already changed, right? So looking for it, and I've hired thousands of people, and I can tell you, by the way, the curious self-taught, you need to be constantly curious and driven, but I would hire that person 100 times out of 100 versus the person that it just sits and learns how to memorize something somebody else teaches them.
Mm-hmm. And doesn't understand the why. They're just doing it. They're following the herd.
Exactly. You know. Exactly. But if you just go to, so what I do, I look deeper. I keep on questioning the why, in just about anything to see where I've made mistakes in critical thinking too.
Interesting. So how did you get to, what made you want to write the book on economics? Well, I would say it's from an economic perspective. It's not solely about economics. You talk about technology and entrepreneurship as well in the book. But
yeah, I talk about a whole bunch of things. There's a whole bunch of islands of knowledge. It actually, is. Funny enough, orthogonal islands of knowledge, right, that I pull together to see where the world's going. It's exactly the same as an entrepreneur does, right? And what's ending up happening today is you have technologists on one camp thinking kind of the singularity and what happens in the world, disconnected from the economics camp that says inflation forever, disconnected from kind of what happens to society. So all these things are disconnected and everybody thinks they're right. And it's actually a pretty simple premise that I lay out. And once you see that premise, and as you, we'll talk about a little bit more today, but once you see that premise and what it means, you can't unsee it. It's impossible to. I haven't had one argument, one actual debate where somebody debated me at the first principles and said I was wrong. Not one. And this turned into a bestseller in multiple markets. You know how much response I'm getting from this and how much speaking to governments, I'm speaking, not from an economist, no one has given me a cogent reason that my thesis isn't right.
Of course, because when you lay it out, it makes sense, but it also makes sense from the view of the people who currently control the system. They don't necessarily have a choice right now, because on one option I see it's they let deflation happen with the amount of debt there is currently in the world, and we go through the worst depression we've ever seen. And yeah, after that, it probably is, we live in a better society, we have better allocation of capital, but it's getting through that period that's going to just suck. And it's either what we keep inflating, we keep inflating. Yeah, people are losing the value of their dollar, or we let deflation happen and we go through just a horrible depression.
Yeah, well, let's go back a step just to kind of the thesis of the book to and then let's get into what you just said, because you're right. So technology is moving exponentially, right? And that means it's doubling every 18 months. So if you, I've said this to what I'll say now, if you fold a piece of paper and you could fold that piece of paper 50 times, that piece of paper will reach from the earth to the sun, from me to the sun. If you could fold that piece of paper on itself 50 times, you can only fold it 7, but if you could fold it 50 times, I've asked that question to tens of thousands of people all over the world, and no one gets the answer. Some people guess the moon. If you've heard it before, sometimes you guess a big number. But if you've never heard that kind of doubling pattern, it's impossible for the human brain to understand it. And I don't use that example to say I'm smarter than people or now somebody has a parlor trick. I use the example to say how bad human beings are, all of us, at understanding exponential patterns. Yet, we have an exponential pattern under technology, driving technology, that doubles and doubles and doubles. And the same reason why people overestimate the power of technology early is the paper, the folding example. On the first fold, or second fold, or fifth fold, it's insignificant. It doesn't look like anything. But there's a whole bunch of people who say, wow, look at this crazy new invention in technology. It's going to do everything. And so it's insignificant. So .com crash, insignificant. Didn't do anything. Remember 95, 99? It wasn't really moving. Technology wasn't really, really moving. We had a whole bunch of people hyped it up. Keeps doubling, keeps doubling, keeps doubling. Well, now we're on fold 33, moving to fold 34. We're in the steep steps of technology. And so the same thing that people do early in technology, they overestimate it. Now they do way worse on the other side. They underestimate what's happening. And if you play that forward to where we are in the cycle, it means most of the deflation is in front of us. Most of the efficiency is in front of us. So the last 50 years of technology growth doubles in the next 2 years. That's kind of how fast it's moving. And we can't comprehend how fast that's moving. So now let's connect what I just said to the financial system. Almost as a test of my hypothesis. So if it's moving that fast, what we should see in the financial system is something that's trying to stop that to be able to keep it moving. So when you look at how much debt the world had kind of pre-COVID, the global debt was $250 trillion to run an $80 trillion global economy. But when you look deeper at that $250 trillion to run an $80 trillion global economy, you realize $185 trillion of the debt came in the last 20 years against this doubling. And so when people are caught in the system, they don't ask. They look at the overall system and they measure all of their results by independent variables. So let's use example housing. Everybody thinks, almost a hard, fast belief, housing always goes up. But they don't ask the question, would housing go up without $185 trillion of stimulus? Nor do they ask, will housing go up in the future without, because if it was 185 over the last 20 years and everything's doubling, to keep in stasis, that debt has to double, more than double, going forward in the next 4 years. And so, when I wrote the book, this was pre-COVID. It laid out this foundation, and everything that's kind of played out in the book is happening in real time. Actually, COVID's an accelerator to the whole thing. And so you see, it is true. And governments are trying to stop that deflation by printing and then monetizing the debt because they have no choice.
Yeah, I think you released the book at almost a perfect time. I think it was released in January, if I'm correct, of this year. And then we have COVID happen a month later. And then 2 months later, we print more money, you know, in March than pretty much all of history. And it's like you just said, COVID is the great accelerator that, yeah, we had record amount of debt and, you know, debt fueled spending before COVID, but now it's just, I mean, they're to keep up with this, deflationary pressure where, like you said, the inflationary aspect has to just continue to rise, like accelerate even more so than we have over the past 20 years.
And you touched on something in this type of environment, you see conspiracy theories everywhere, right? Every single thing is a conspiracy theory, from politics to everything. And it's because people are in pain, wondering kind of what's causing it all. And so if you back up, what's causing it all is exactly what we just said. When you destroy the kind of free markets by socializing losses, by printing money, what you're doing, what central banks have done, is they kept asset prices high because those asset prices should have fallen. And then anybody who owns the assets gets rich out of keeping them high. And then there's a whole bunch of people on the other side who can't pay for those assets. Their healthcare is going up in price, their food is going up in price, their housing is going up in price, the rents are going up in price. And that inflationary policy is actually wage deflation, right? So that's what it is. So the people on one side are losing badly as they get their pocket picked, and the wealthy are getting wealthier and wealthier because they're the beneficiaries of the inflation. So that gives rise to uprisings and everything else, or socialism, that cannot fix the system either, because there's a whole bunch of people that say, okay, free money over here, I need free money to pay for those high prices. And no one's asking where the money comes from. So, you destroy all the foundations of capitalism. And if, for any of your listeners who know Joseph Schumpeter, creative destruction is one of the corner pins of capitalism. It requires failure. And so businesses fail when they get beaten by an upstart, right? So Kodak failed, even though they created the digital camera. Blockbuster failed because Netflix saw what was happening in technology and moved there faster. And capitalism requires creative destruction. But by preventing creative destruction at capitalism itself, kind of at the company level itself, because it was too hard to do for governments, what all that is happening is creative destruction is moving up to the monetary level, and currencies are going to fail over and over and over again.
Okay, let's take a step back again, because we're getting deep into it, but we haven't really defined the distinction between these two things. So just lay it out for people clear and simple, like, what is inflation? Let's start there, and okay. We'll start with inflation, yeah. And then we'll get to deflation.
Okay. So inflation, the simplest way to look at it is, inflation is when your money goes up. Sorry, your goods and services go up in relation to your money. So things cost more, right? And deflation is the opposite side of that. Your money is worth more, and goods and services in relation to that money go down in price. And so people get all bent out of shape on good, bad, anything on those two issues. And it's not what it matters. What matters is where you have your money and how the system is designed. So for inflation, if you have a whole bunch of debt and you have assets, that's a really good thing for you, because you pay back the debt with cheaper dollars tomorrow, and your assets go up in price. So that's the way the world works today. And so there's no doubt we have a lot of debt, right? That we have, because the system is designed to actually to leverage that debt and everything else, and then make it cheaper to pay it back later on. But nobody asked, and so we all believe that without even asking. That's a good thing. That's a great thing. Yet in our own personal lives, when things cost less and we get more, that seems like a good thing. Like, why wouldn't we want that, right? So you have that incongruence, right, of two different systems. But it actually doesn't matter what I just said. So that's that. What I just said is the truth on both sides. But it actually doesn't matter for what we're talking about, because the point here is technology creates that efficiency that creates deflation no matter what. And there is nothing governments can do short of destroying society that can stop that. It's moving that fast. There isn't a technology founder I know, there isn't a technology executive I know that is putting technology into their company to increase their cost. Point is, it decreases costs and we get more abundance from it. When you use technology, you should free your time.
Yeah, that's the point.
That's the point. So yeah. and that time savings that we use technology for, it means deflation, efficiency, deflation. Prices should come down, abundance should go up, and we should have more time. Yet the entire system is designed to stop that.
Because and why is that?
Because if prices go down, you already said it, but if prices go down, essentially the Wizard of Oz, you see the man behind the curtain, right? The entire debt unwinds, because with deflation, the debt gets impossible to pay back. It gets the real cost of the debt goes up because prices go down. And so the debt cost explodes and there's a reset. So how far we are past to this point of rescue right now is you could have saved the system as it looks probably 20 years ago. And interest rates went up instead of down, and you would have had a massive recession. You would have credit destruction and a whole bunch of you would have the system go on. Today, because the can was kicked down the road and papered over, and you created more debt out of the problem, more debt out of the problem, more debt out of the problem. Now if you allow deflation to take hold, you'll have a 90% or more correction in everything, asset prices, stock prices. But that's not all. Banks will fail. Every bank would fail, because who do you think has the loan paper against against those assets, right? And so when that happens, the entire system would unwind, and it's just a reset of a different form. And that's what governments are trying to stop at all costs, but they can't stop. So they can stop it, but they have to by printing ever more money. So that's what they're that. So instead of looking at bad people running a system, think of what would you. And right now they don't have a choice. So you can expect tons more printing. You can expect the Treasury to overtake. So the Fed used to be independent, an independent body. You can expect the Treasury or government to effectively take over that function and do helicopter money and everything else to the population to try to drive inflation and fiscal stimulus. But all of this won't help what we're talking about. It'll make it worse.
Yeah, you're putting a Band-Aid over a dam that's breaking.
Yeah.
And then did you see this week that Biden wants to name Janet Yellen his Treasury Secretary?
Yeah, I did see that.
Yeah, so it's just, if Biden gets in office, if he gets in office, we'll see how that plays out. But, I mean, we're just setting the road for just record money printing.
So here's the...
Hey, Jeff. Yeah. Yeah. Could you mind muting your phone, please? It's really, really loud when it dings.
Right. I'm trying to. I can't. I turned off my phone, but I'm... Oh, there you go. Yeah, I think it did. Okay.
Sweet.
Janet Yellen. Okay, so... Do you want to just go back and ask that question again about Janet Yellen, and we'll go from there?
Yeah, what I was saying is, if Biden gets in office, he named Janet Yellen his Treasury Secretary, who used to be She was at the Fed. How long ago was this?
Yeah, and what I would say there is, and this is really important, because when I look at in the States, but it's not as bad in Canada yet, but it will be. But when I look at in the States, I see people on both sides of this political divide yelling, screaming at each other, thinking that a change in an actor can change the system.
Yeah, it's comical.
It's comical on both sides. What we just talked about, there is no way with Trump's tax reduction and the how much spending just went through on that watch, right? How much $4 trillion deficit this year, right? It doesn't matter who's in power. Changing an actor won't make a difference on the entire system. Yet everybody thinks it's an actor change that makes a difference, and so they're heads wrapped around the axle, right? On something that is just a sideshow of the whole thing. But that's what typically happens. People can't see. They think that it's a change in somebody, a change in an actor in the system that can change it.
Yeah. Well, this is something that really bothers me about modern politics is they have these issues where they set it and they say, oh, we fundamentally disagree on this. And people magnify that and they say, okay, this is a huge thing. Like this one issue, we are on complete different sides on. And they choose to focus on those issues that they think are the big deal. And then when you look at both parties and here in the US, look at the things that they agree on. Both sides agree on printing money. That's something that it doesn't matter who gets in office. They're both like, a lot of people here in the States will argue that the conservatives are conservative and, you know, we're going to have lower taxes, but it's like, look at what Trump just did when he was in office. Both sides are going to print astronomical amounts of money. Both sides are truly left. There's just one that's a little bit further left.
Yeah. They both have to, it's because it's mathematically impossible for them not to. Right. That's the thing. If they don't, the entire system globally collapses. So they both will. And imagine being on your watch that the whole system fails. So then when you look at a population, you want to get votes, where is the biggest part of the population failing? Right. And so it's really easy to turn a whole bunch of people who believe capitalism has failed them. By the way, it has. Printing money by central banks just increased asset prices and hurt a whole bunch of people. It picked the pockets of a whole bunch of savers and gave it to the wealthy. So it's really easy to turn a population who now doesn't believe in capitalism or free markets.
Sorry, I don't want to interrupt you here, but I do want to make an important distinction, like a little nuance there, is it's not full capitalism. It's crony capitalism that has failed. And that angst is now being magnified into socialism. It's thinking capitalism has failed, but it's not the correct form of capitalism that has failed.
Bingo. It has nothing to do, both sides, these aren't free markets, right? So when you stop failure in a market and bail somebody out, you don't have capitalism. You don't have free market capitalism. You have crony capitalism. So the rise of socialism is a predictable consequence. And what I would do, so on both sides, especially in the US, a lot more empathy on how each side is experiencing this is required. Bigger than that is look deeper. Look at the first principles on what's causing it all. And most people will find, oh my God, it's none of this. This is a total sideshow to everything that's really happening.
Mm-hmm. it changes your entire world when you can see it that way, because you're like, these social issues don't even matter. And this is where the Bitcoin meme, fix the money, fix the world comes into play, because the money is the system of money that we live in, rather, is what's causing all of these problems.
All of them. So many that And by the way, on Bitcoin, every single person, whether you have $100, whether you have $50, every single person has their own vote.
Yeah. I tweeted a couple days ago around the election. I was like, I didn't vote red. I didn't vote blue. I voted orange.
Right. Right.
So how did you get into Bitcoin?
So I've been in for a while, but I would say first a curiosity early on when the white paper was done. I just wanted to learn. So I didn't actually get in at that time, but I was curious at that time. And so started to dig deeper on what this could be. But as you laid out, I didn't actually come to the conclusion how powerful Bitcoin was and how big a change it could mean for the world until a couple of years ago. And it was out of the economic side of it. It was a realization that governments are very unlikely, or are not going to do what they need to do to fix the money. And so just like a company, and I use this analogy, I use it a lot in the book, it's very difficult for a company to, even when they see a competitor, to change everything they do and address that competitor. That's why Netflix emerges from Blockbuster, and Blockbuster puts candy aisles in their store to try to stop it. A lot of times, when your technology is moving so fast, what the monopoly does at that time is they dig in, they try to protect the monopoly, and they actually create the competitor faster. So Bitcoin is that competitor to the entire fiat monetary system. So I got to it from economics. I got to it from what will this look like? What does a typical business do to try to stop a competitor? What does a competitor do to win that? And how does this look? And when I looked at all of those variables, I realized, well, Bitcoin, I believe Bitcoin is eventually going to, all currencies are going to be either pegged to Bitcoin. And if that doesn't happen, then Bitcoin will continue to advance and it'll be a form of payment as well. So if central banks and governments don't peg their currencies to Bitcoin, what will happen? And if they try to stop it, then there would be a massive innovation around it as a payment layer.
Right. So I would say I had those same hesitancies when I first got into Bitcoin, because it hadn't gone through the test of time yet. In the early days when they say 21 million and you create this novel piece of technology and you say all these things, it's decentralized. I mean, in the early days, they could have increased the supply, and it didn't stand the test of time of, you know, saying that 21 millions, that's going to be the limit. I mean, if we would have changed it early on back then, it, you know, who knows, Bitcoin may have not played out to be like what it is now. But now, after we've gone through sort of all the internal civil wars in Bitcoin's history, we've seen that they're not going to change. So you can look at it and say the absolute scarcity of Bitcoin, we're not there yet. We're going through, I mean, it's continually getting tighter and tighter on the supply. At one point, it will be fundamentally and absolutely scarce. We're not there yet, but we're confident that that's not going to change into the future.
Yeah, that's exactly it. So when you look at how the entire design, it's such a beautiful design. The entire system, right? Reinforcing game theory, reinforcing a whole bunch of things. It might be mankind's greatest invention. And I know that sounds crazy to potentially a whole bunch of your audience, but I suspect where we are on this path, how early we are on this path, people will know what I mean by that in time. So if you look at to help people, if you look at the internet in 1995, the internet in 1995 had 15 million users. And the titans of industry looked at the internet in 95 and said, this is a joke. Paul Krugman came out and said in 1998 that the internet will have no greater impact on our economies than the fax machine. And so what I'm getting at is it's very normal not to see an exponential pattern. It's very normal not to understand what that means as it keeps adopting. Bitcoin has the exact same, if you look back at the kind of wallets per year, it's growing at the same rate as the internet was. And so people, why people make that mistake is the same as people made this mistake in 95 and on the internet, is at that time took half an hour to download a cat picture. And so you couldn't see what the internet would become. Yet the people who saw what the internet would become created they're the titans of business today. Same thing is happening at Bitcoin. That's the protocol level and what's happening. So people think, wow, the on-ramps, off-ramps, this is difficult to use. All of the things that you could say about Bitcoin today, you won't be able to say about Bitcoin in 5 years. As it keeps on ramping, and so it's growing at that same order of magnitude, and the innovation is happening at the same order of magnitude as well.
How much of it would you say is people don't see it, or that they don't want to see it? I feel like some of the people that I talk to about Bitcoin, especially if they have a background in Keynesian economics, it's like they're doing mental gymnastics to just find an argument against it, because a lot of notable economists have come out and said that this can't work. That's who they look to. They don't really challenge the status quo of what they're actually learning. They don't look at Austrian economics and sort of all of the history of what real economics is. And they just look at it through sort of what they've been brainwashed to believe. And they just sort of parrot arguments that they don't even truly understand.
Well, just ask this. I said this on another podcast. My book could have said that this. Technology is moving exponentially. That exponential growth of technology means exponential efficiency. That exponential efficiency means deflation, exponential deflation. Full stop. Tell me what to do about it. Right? Like, challenge somebody with the facts, and everything I just said there is true. And so what you'd see is the entire thing, what you're talking about, Keynesian economics and everything else, is they're arguing a different time and place. And what they're saying, because what they're saying is this: I vote for manipulation. And tons of manipulation, and then more government control, because that's what the vote is for. It's not for free markets. So, and let's be really crystal clear about that. Everything that doesn't allow the natural forces of that to happen, of that deflation to happen, is a vote against free markets. And so ask them why that isn't true, and they won't be able to find an answer.
Absolutely. I mean, I want to talk about the role of governments at some point. We can get into it now if you want, and that sort of intervention into certain markets. Like, one of the biggest problems that I see with higher education right now, and the reason we have sort of bloated administrations at universities, we have just rising costs of tuition to keep up with that bloat in the system, is because of government stepping into a market that never should have been a part of. Like, if you look at the cost of college tuition in the 70s, like before they really started to subsidize loans, it was much, much lower. And it's coincidental. Yeah. At the same, like that was the same period where we got off the gold standard, and that probably has some contribution to it as well. But I mean, they directly intervened in the higher education market and sort of incentivized college students to take out debt and take out debt and take out debt. And that allowed more people supposedly to go to college and not work through college, which was totally possible in the 70s. Now it's almost impossible to go through college now, work through it, and pay it off, you know, by the time you're done. It's not impossible, but it's very, very hard. And I think that's solely attributed to government intervention.
All of this is. So the housing example I gave earlier, it all is. So again, what would house $1 trillion of stimulus in the last 20 years? People would see the answer. What would all things cost? So the reason why people see, okay, deflation only works where technology is because, so my phone gets more abundant and it's better and better. So all those things are moving to free. Though that's in spite of their dollars being worth way less, right? That's how fast it's moving. But if you think about, let's use an example, because it doesn't matter where you are in the world if this is happening. In the US, if everybody in China knows they have to devalue their currency, essentially make labor cheaper, and that's what the US is doing too, and every government, so they have to print a whole bunch of money. What will people in China do with that money before they do it? Wouldn't they try to get it out of China before that happens? And wouldn't they try to park it in real estate in the US or Canada or anything else before that happened? So you can see the stimulus everywhere is just causing all of the unintended consequences. Your example on education, it tied to what I talked about before, education is already free. It doesn't matter what governments do. It's already going to change. The higher and higher you drive that price, ironically, the more the government does this and more they step in to try to control this, the faster companies or people need to use technology in their own lives to remove so they're not a zombie of the state, right? So the faster companies need to move to technology and reduce labor faster to gain a competitive advantage, so they're not a zombie of the state requiring money from government forever. So you're actually, all the policies are actually making the entire thing worse, but it's too late.
Right. One of the examples, I can't remember where I heard this argument, may have been from you, may have been, I don't know where exactly I saw this, but they talk about Donald Trump becoming president, and he's looked at as this ideal businessman. And it's like, if maybe this was your book that I read.
It was me.
Okay. I wanted to make sure I wasn't positive. Sometimes I read so much, I forget like where exactly I read something. But yeah, so you talk about this in your book, that he wouldn't become the businessman, and he definitely wouldn't have been the president off of the piggyback of him being this great businessman if 2008 would have actually come to this deflationary reset that you talk about.
And that's the thing. So sometimes I'll say something that strikes kind of a chord because it's such a landmine around, it's so politicized. But again, and I'm glad you said it that way. It's not I'm pro-Trump, against Trump or anything else. I'm saying the entire system doesn't work. And if you look at the unfairness and what that means, 2008, Trump would have been wiped out if the entire system, monetary system at that time would have been, we had LC facilities at my company at that time. So we're trading globally with different banks and around the world. And there was a time just before the massive bailouts, there was a time where all the banks stopped taking LCs. So credit stopped. Right. So, and because banks didn't trust other banks having the capital there to be able to pay, so they didn't trust and so you can imagine that credit stopping all over the world, what that would have looked like. And so, in that environment, I understand why a whole bunch of money was printed, a whole bunch of everything else was. I do understand. Because maybe the people at the table said, we don't have a choice, we have to, because the consequences are so bad. But I also understand that it gifted the architects of the crisis free money at taxpayers' expense. And one of those people that it gifted was Trump, because that whole system, his whole system would have collapsed at the time had that not been gifted. So when you have people that say how great they are in business without realizing that it was luck, or it was a coin flip that could have gone the other way, I just think it's disingenuous.
It is one on one part luck. It's also understanding the manipulation and how the system functions to say, yeah, real estate's a good investment because the entire system is fundamentally flawed. Real estate's not a good investment because it's constantly sought after and it's just fundamentally scarce and there's going to be an increasing demand. No, it's going to be a good investment because the Fed's going to backstop everything. And if we ever have any sort of liquidity crisis, like stemming from a credit crisis, then the Fed's just going to print money and it's going to, in nominal terms, it's going to drive up the value of real estate. And that's why real estate's a good investment.
Let's push on that a little bit more, because that's what ends up happening. People see their wealth in one silo and they miss what's happening overall. And this is really positive for Bitcoin, but it's not so positive for real estate. I'll ask you a question. What did real estate look like in Germany in the 30s, right? As they were hyperinflating. Same, real estate was going up and there was a whole bunch of creepy people creating a whole bunch of wealth out of that real estate going up. Who did the populace turn against when that happened, right? So what ends up happening is, because real estate is priced in the value of your own currency and it moves up along with the inflating asset prices and everything else, people don't question what happens next. So real estate will continue to move up if governments continue to print. Right? That's a given. Now, what will happen out of that is governments are going to be forced to tax that real estate very differently. And you can't move it. And beyond the taxing very differently, things are going to be a lot more unsafe in the world if that continues to happen and you can't move the real estate. So I don't think real estate is a really good store of value. At least if you were all in on one thing or all in on one asset class, I don't think it's a very good store of value in what's coming. It could be a piece of a portfolio, but I think it's dangerous to be overextended in that portfolio.
I would completely agree with that. So I want to go back to what you said about Germany. So would you say that this sort of behavior from governments with this inflationary pressure on society that it leads to populism, like we saw in World War II, like, or in Germany pre-World War II, where this populism and sort of nationalism, would you say that it has any correlation?
Yeah, 100%. That is what it is. It's really easy to turn a population against another part of the population because they believe they don't have, they were left out, especially if those people can't pay their education, can't pay their food bills, can't pay their housing. It's very, very easy. It's happening on both sides. I have a whole bunch of very wealthy friends, billionaire friends, who think all of their wealth came from their ingenuity. It didn't. Most of their wealth came from money printing that they were the beneficiaries of. So the kids go to private schools, the kids get better access to everything else. And most of it came from monetary easing, yet they think it's because it came from capitalism. Now, they were successful in business to a degree that then created the wealth and everything else. So some of it did, but if you push on this and ask them, where did the money come from? They would realize this, right? And we've had this debate. But when you have somebody who believes that they are entitled to it against somebody else who's getting killed by the same process, yes, populism explodes.
Yeah, so I feel like we're setting the stage right now, and we have just this little melting pot of things that are cooking. And so we can go a couple different ways with this. So one question that I have that I saw after we sort of just printed astronomical money in March, why people I saw people questioning who weren't necessarily thinking about economics at all. They said, well, why am I paying taxes if the government can just print money?
Yeah.
So I think it's interesting that you just said that this leads to populism and nationalism, which at some point leads to socialism, which leads to very, very, very high taxes. So it's like this collapse is going to come from, it's almost inevitable. So on one hand, if we let deflation happen, the economy is going to collapse. We can continue to inflate and eventually inflate it until it collapses and the dollar loses its value, which we've seen over the course of history whenever governments go through periods of hyperinflation, usually in war times. Or three, you know, we continue to inflate at a nominal level that, you know, we can withstand for who knows how long, because whenever the US is the world dollar reserve currency, you know, we'll probably see other currencies collapse before the dollar. And then you go through this period where you almost live in socialism and you don't have any money anyway. So I think it's interesting what's sort of going on right here. And then you have this catalyst, or actually let's say you have multiple catalysts. You have COVID, which is one, but you also have Bitcoin, which is technology that's naturally deflationary and it's scarce. So I just think you have a lot of different forces at play right here that are all pressuring on each other at the same time.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. And Bitcoin isn't deflationary. Bitcoin will go up in price a whole bunch because it's scarcity, but what it does is it forces a monetary system over time that allows kind of nature to take its place. So it forces a free market. It forces deflation. And with deflation and the way technology is going, think about what an entrepreneur does, right? Every company I'm helping, so I wouldn't be involved in a company unless it was trying to produce kind of something better for people, us. That's what an entrepreneur does. But it's harsh. If it doesn't work, they go broke, as does the capital in their company, right? Everybody loses. So it's such a harsh process to go through. And the only way you win is if you drive value to humanity. That's it. Because everybody has a vote to use your thing or what your invention. And if they don't use it, it doesn't work. So if you think about that innovation and entrepreneurial process, it must be deflationary. It must be, right? Because new companies come on and try to create. And if margins are too high in a monopoly, then an entrepreneur uses technology and destroys those margins and creates something better. And if they don't create something better, they fail. So that whole process has to be deflationary for us. And what that means, if you let that process work, then the abundance is widely shared. If you don't let that work, then the abundance is, then there is no abundance. It's concentrated and manipulated. And that's what you're seeing today. So Bitcoin forces what I just said to happen. It's a forcing function to get back to sound money. And every road against that is voting for more manipulation.
So I have this feeling, and it seems like a lot of Bitcoiners think that the system that we currently live in is malevolent, that these actors are truly malevolent. They're doing this on purpose. They're doing it to basically steal money from the public with the hidden tax, and to sort of increase their sphere of power. Would you say that that's the...
I completely disagree.
Yeah. So it seems like you completely disagree with this. You seem like this is their only option, and they're truly thinking in the best interest of people because they don't want them to go through this deflationary reset.
Or they haven't thought about it at the level I just did. But the if to tomorrow, Kaz, you have all the control. You can do anything you want. No, you don't have to ask anybody. What do?
Anything.
Anything. Like you have the control tomorrow. Tell me what you do.
And I have unlimited resources to do whatever I want.
Well, you have the existing functioning policies, everything else. You have all the policies on one side, and you have kind of this emerging Bitcoin on the other. So you have the exactly scenario we have today. You can make changes. What do?
I'm not sure the answer you're looking for. Part of me says I would just travel if there were just no restrictions and I could just freely move around the world.
No, I'm asking, what do you do to fix the system?
Oh, what do I do to fix the system? I move us to a Bitcoin standard.
But okay, now when you do, you realize that the entire rest of the thing collapses.
Yes. But I think there's a difference in this sort of thinking once you've studied it. Not every single person hears deflation and that pretty much the whole world's economy is going to be miserable for pretty much everybody, and says that that's a fundamentally good thing in on the long run.
Yeah. Right. So all we're talking about is the time horizon. If you just did that tomorrow, by the way, Bitcoin isn't ready for that tomorrow.
Agreed.
So if you couldn't do that tomorrow, you could do it over time. You could transition, by the way, and that's what's happening. It's transitioning over time. But you couldn't make any change. All of the existing, all of the governments fail. All of the, how do you get your electricity? How do you healthcare? Like every single thing on the system is built to the existing system. And so that unwind, which will happen, or that transition, which will happen over time, is happening. It's just, if it happened all at once, it'd just be brutal for society. Like you just have revolution everywhere. And so that's the problem of where we are right now. And so I tend to not. That's why I kind of say any actor in the system is just doing what they're going to try to do to protect the system. And there are some bad actors, don't get me wrong. but there's bad actors in any system. If you can take advantage of a system, people will. And the existing monetary fiat system, you can take advantage of it everywhere.
Right. So when you think about this and you say, you look at somebody that's at the Fed, whoever's in charge of the Fed at the time, and you say, you point the finger and say, they're evil. They want to just destroy society by printing money, and they just want to inflate assets. And, you know, they're trying to increase their net worth out of their own incentives and interests. But then you can look at it and say, you know, maybe they're not necessarily trying to do that. And if you were in their position, you would probably do the exact same thing.
So that's what I would say. No, because I don't know what you would do right now to be able to.
What would you do? Let's say you have the choice to do it. What would you do? Would you say it'd be? Are you trying to calculate the
when I wrote the,
pros
when
and
I,
the cons?
When I wrote the book, I thought that there was a chance that you could transition slowly and kind of let things slowly come down and have a new monetary regime that could move to something like Bitcoin over time that would allow kind of a lower rate of deflation. Now I realize, especially with COVID, that accelerated everything else and accelerated all the printing and everything and accelerated technology. That's impossible. So it's going to, I believe it will be a Bitcoin standard. I believe that will happen, but it's just going to take time. And a monopoly doesn't die overnight, right? And even if that monopoly is a government, is a credit system, if monopoly is Sears, right? Before Amazon came in and everything else, a monopoly doesn't die overnight. It's typically thrashes around on its way, and that's what's going to happen here.
This is what Parker Lewis talks about, gradually then suddenly. It seems like we're heading towards the suddenly. Maybe I'm a little biased, and, you know, maybe geographically where I am, we have a contested election in the part of the world that's supposed to be the ideal for democracy. We also have record money printing at when we're in the driver's seat for the global economy. And
I think
we have a rising price of Bitcoin. So
yeah, I think it could go on a lot longer than you think. Because if you, let's assume Biden gets in, but actually doesn't matter either side. There will be fiscal stimulus. That fiscal stimulus. So when I say Treasury, right now, the biggest beneficiaries to the system is designed with the Fed have been the banks, because the banks take bad assets off their balance sheet, give them to the Fed. Fed gives fresh money to the banks, but the banks won't lend because there's not a good enough economy or business creation to be able to lend to. So why M2 is collapsed is that. So that money that Fed is printing is going into asset price inflation, but it's not getting to the wider economy. So the next step, when I said the Treasury hijacks the Fed, government officials become the Fed, is that money is going to get into the market. It's going to drive fiscal spending. It's going to drive a whole bunch of stuff that is going to, for a short term, make people feel better. And when I say relative periods of calm, that is one of those relative periods of calm that might actually seem like this could go on for longer, right? Because you're deep on Bitcoin, I am as well, then we know where that goes. But a lot of people will see that period of calm and say, oh, okay, it's better now. Unaware that that period of calm here caused a corresponding somewhere else in the world, a period of chaos. And back and forth, you're going to see this whipsaw as currency after currency around the globe get destroyed. So I agree with you, but I think it goes on for longer than people think. Now, the whole ride, the whole way, if you're looking at price of Bitcoin and how many people are coming on to Bitcoin, kind of on that network effect, what you'll see is a constant acceleration and growth, because all of these signposts will bring more people onto Bitcoin. And so I do agree with what Parker said, gradually, then suddenly.
Yeah, so I tweeted this week and I said, the people that are basically saying Bitcoin's going to go to 100K, which if you're paying attention to Bitcoin and you're on Twitter, it's almost every single person that holds Bitcoin just believes that that's going to happen. So I believe that's going to happen just because I'm bullish on Bitcoiners, and I believe that people are going to make that happen. It's going to be self-fulfilling because everybody just takes it for granted now. In the tweet, I said, I think 500K Bitcoin's in play right now. Not that it's about money. It's not about money at all. I would truly rather solve the world problems that we've been talking about during this podcast than say that anybody who buys Bitcoin is going to get rich. That's not what I'm trying to say at all. I'm just saying, if you've been paying attention, you understand exponential technologies. To say that Bitcoin is going to 100K is bearish. I think it's like, I mean, from the last bull run, I would compare us right now to like late fall of 2016. Bitcoin's at like $500. So if you just say Bitcoin went from $500 late fall to early January 2018, it hit almost $20,000. That's around a 3,200% increase. And if you say, okay, that, let's just say that exact same thing happens, that puts us at 500K. And let's just exclude the money printing that's going on in all economies across the world, not just the US. It's happening in Europe. It's happening in Australia. It's happening in pretty much every major society. They're devaluing their currencies. And this is happening at the exact same time of all these social issues. And it's like Bitcoin is at the same time, there's
increasing demand pressure with a tighter supply. And you have some of the biggest hedge funds and now publicly traded companies acquiring Bitcoin with their balance sheets. And you're going to tell me, yeah, it's going to only do, you know, this much. It's like, I mean, there's nothing that's out of state, out of question right now, because you're talking the bottom for the dollar is pretty much limitless. That's if you're comparing it to the dollar. Now, when you take into account the global macro perspective and there's multiple different competing currencies, it's really just what you're measuring Bitcoin against. And then it's like, you know, the top is limitless.
Yeah. And you just said something that's important there. In what currency? Right. If you measured in this Turkish lira today, it's all time highs because the Turkish lira is collapsing, and that's going to happen in every currency. So if you measure it in purchase power, it's probably the best way to do it, but it's hard to measure in like when, what currency you're going to measure it in. And so people, because what's kind of the other side, all these printing of money, and they're not seeing the currency being destroyed. They're not, the kind of the measurement device is wrong too in Bitcoin. I agree with you where it's going. Yeah, I agree with you that it has to go there. And I think price action is part of the thing that is in the whole network effect, is in the design of it to create game theory to get more people onto it. So price is an important part of it, that as it moves there, it solves a whole bunch of other problems. Mm-hmm. One of the things I don't think is talked about a lot is, if I said, what do I expect to happen? I expect during this, what we're seeing right now, this halving run, to run away in price, like you said. And then as we approach kind of the next halving, that prices come way down. Mm-hmm. But I suspect that as they come way down, the story that a lot of people will tell themselves, not the long-term hodlers, but the story that a lot of people will tell themselves that just got in on the price run is, oh, it's failing because governments are offering digital currencies now, or this, or this, because which is going to happen at around the same time, right? And they're gonna miss the next run, what takes it to the next run, because of biasing the result of Bitcoin in any given time against what's happening outside in the world.
Completely agree. And you hear this seems to be the new parroted narrative. That's the argument for why Bitcoin's gonna fail, is because central bank digital currencies. And it's like, we already have digital currencies. Like, yeah. The dollar is digital. When we print money, we print digital money. We don't print physical money. And the only things that are really going to change, I mean, it's still going to be heavily surveilled. They're going to know even more about your purchasing history, because you're going to have a digital wallet, whether it's Apple, whatever it is, and you're going to spend your Fed coins at accepted institutions, and they're going to know every single thing you've ever purchased. You're going to, who you send money to, what you send money for, but they're also going to have an easier way to tax people, because they're just going to pull it directly from your wallet. And I don't think that's a threat for Bitcoin, because they can still infinitely print money in this system, and they can still cut people out of the system. And that's the two arguments for Bitcoin are scarcity and censorship resistance.
Well, here's the thing that people don't talk. I have a piece coming out on this at the end of the month here, but people don't talk about this piece. Remember, the banks have been the largest beneficiaries of the Fed policy up till now. Is that fair? And the people that are close to the banks, essentially people who have access to the Fed window of taking bad assets off their balance sheet and trading them for good assets. That fair? So they've been the number one beneficiary. When currencies, essentially when digital currencies come in to be able to bypass that function, you're putting the banks in direct competition with the Fed and government. And so what do you think the banks are about to do?
They're going to fail.
But also, why do you think JP Morgan and Fidelity and everybody else is starting to talk about Bitcoin?
Mm-hmm.
Right? You bring way more people to the new medium because you're competing against everybody.
Wow. Okay. So this is something I've never thought about. And I know you said you're on limited time. So let's try to wrap this. But so you're saying that the reason that banks are pushing these custody services for Bitcoin is because now governments and banks are in competition with Fed coins.
Not yet, but close. They're going to be, and they can see the writing on the wall that that once government is in competition, then they don't need the bank anymore as the intermediary to get money to the public. And so once that's not needed, why do you have a bank in the first place?
Yeah. And this is why I just said the banks are going to fail. But now your argument is that the banks are going to hang on for dear life, and that's going to push for Bitcoin.
Well, that's what, yeah, the banks are going to help drive the on-ramps to all of the policy, all of everything else are going to help drive the on-ramps to Bitcoin, because otherwise they're dead.
Wow. The competing global landscape and the game theory that's about to take place is going to be very interesting to watch.
Big time. Big time, yes.
Well, Jeff, hey, I really appreciate your time today. It was a fun conversation. Is there anything else you'd like to say before we hop off?
No, it's been great. Thanks, Cass.
Awesome. Hey, thank you very much.
I do have one more, and I typically say this. For a lot of the people, or a lot of the people that are listening, they will be thinking, it's that person, it's that group of people, everything else. I'm against those people. Careful of that narrative. It's what normally happens when you go through a cycle like this. It's less about that than you think. If you understand the first principles of what's happening underneath it, you can make good decisions on where to put your money, where to put your time.
I think that's very important in the time and history we're going through right now. It's interesting that Bitcoin is very cyclical. Technology seems to be cyclical. History is very cyclical. And we're heading towards a stage where people are pointing fingers and they're saying that this is happening because of this. I don't have this because of you. And it's becoming a very us versus them. And it's important to remind people that, hey, we're all going through this exact same thing. Let's look at the root cause of the problem and try to solve it.
You bet.
Awesome. Hey, great conversation. I appreciate your time today, Jeff.
No problem. Thanks, guys.
Bye-bye.